Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and the following interview is being republished from the Classical Ideas podcast. This is a podcast run by Greg Soden, and it's absolutely terrific. If you like the NBN, I'm sure that you'll like Classical Ideas. You can find it at classicalideaspodcast.libsyn.com or on iTunes. I hope you enjoy the following interview.
This is Classical Ideas with Greg Soden. Welcome to Classical Ideas. This is Greg Soden. In the American Midwest, a brand new Zen training monastery is now open. Kurinji is a monastery in the Rinzai Zen Buddhist tradition, located on 17 forested acres near Reedsburg, Wisconsin, about 50 miles from Madison. Under development since 2008, Kurinji is now open for its first residents as of March 2018. As a private residence for ordained monastics, Kurinji is led under the guidance of Mado Mor Roshi. From his biography at Kurinji.org, Mado Roshi is the abbot of Kurinji Monastery in Wisconsin. He studied under three Rinzai Zen masters, Tenzan Toyota Rokoji, under whom he also endured training in traditional martial arts, Dogen Hosokawa Roshi, and Sozan Meller Roshi. All are in the lineage of Amora Sogen Roshi, perhaps the most famous Rinzai Zen master of the 20th century, who is further renowned as a master of calligraphy and swordsmanship. In 2008, Mado Roshi received Inka Shome, or Mind Seal, designating him an 86th generation Zen Dharma heir and a 48th generation holder of the lineage descended from Rinzai. Like many of the teachers in this lineage, his instruction stresses the embodied nature of Zen realization, often making use of physical culture and fine arts as complementary disciplines. In particular, he has stressed instruction of the internal energetic practices transmitted in Rinzai Zen. Mado Roshi's book, The Rinzai Zen Way, A Guide to Practice, is out from Shambhala Publications in March 2018. The focus of our conversation is his book, and I highly recommend picking up a copy. It's incredibly accessible to anyone, even if you've never read a book about Zen in your life. As a very special inclusion in this episode, the abbot graciously performed the Four Great Vows, a chant recited during Zen practice at the end of this conversation. It is a very special piece of this episode, and I hope you listen to the end to hear it. For more information, you should visit Kurinji.org, that's Kurinji.org, for more information or to contact the monastery. Without further delay, here is my conversation with Mado Mor Roshi. Welcome to Classical Ideas. I am here today with Mado Mor. Mato, thank you so much for coming on Classical Ideas.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
Can you go ahead and start by just introducing yourself a little bit to the audience?
Well, I'm the abbot of Korinji, which is a Rinzai Zen monastery, which is a new thing. It's just been founded or just been completed. It's located near Madison, Wisconsin. So essentially, that's my primary vocation and duty as a Zen teacher there. And we're extremely thrilled to have a new training facility specifically for Rinzai Zen in the heart of the North American Midwest. That's the project which has been my life's dream, and it's finally coming to fruition. So I'm very happy to talk about it with you.
Fantastic. And I know that your official title is a Roshi, correct?
Well, Roshi is a title which is used for Zen teachers. And in the Rinzai Zen tradition, it specifically is only used for people who have received what's called Inka or Inka Shomei, which is the certification as a fully transmitted teacher. It's not a real title. It's something a student would use for a teacher, but it's not something that I would put on a business card, for example.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, it's fine. It's fine to use that word for me, but Mato is fine too.
Excellent. So you are the first abbot that I have had on the show. And am I correct that your training monastery, Korinji, is opening up like basically as we speak?
Yeah, the first Ango, which is the first period of formal monastic training, begins this coming Wednesday, March 14th.
And is that like the first official day of opening?
It is. It is. We've obviously been using the place for practice for some years now. We've been developing the land there since 2009. But this is the first time we'll have people in residence doing formal monastic training. So it's quite exciting.
Amazing. So since you're the first abbot I've had on the show, what will the day-to-day life be like as a full-time live-in abbot? Like if you were to come to like a career day at like the high school that I teach at, what would you tell people about what your job will be as a full-time monastic abbot?
I would tell them to choose wisely. You know, it's a life centered on practice, and it's a life centered on community and service to one another. It's a rigorous schedule by some standards. There's very little sleep. There's a lot of, obviously, meditation practice, but manual labor and other activities. It's a full day. There's not much time for rest, and there's certainly not much time for indulging in one's creature comforts or personal preferences. So it's demanding, but the rewards are immense, and it's the kind of place that I think we need more of in this country if Zen is going to survive. That's why we're so excited about it.
And you're in the Midwest, too. Like, you are regionally appropriate to me. Like, I could legitimately drive to your monastery within about a day's drive.
Oh, yeah. And I would like to say also that people are very welcome to visit us, you know, as long as they give us some heads up that they're coming. It's a private residence for monastics, and it's what's called a Senmon Dojo or a Sodo, which is specifically a rigorous training monastery where folks who are interested in ordination can train and receive that. But that being said, we intend it to be open to anyone. And if someone wanted to come just for a day or a weekend to practice with us, as long as they let us know, certainly anyone's welcome.
Fantastic. So how many full-time students will you have as Korinji gets going off the ground as a full-time live-in center?
When we designed it, we set it up to be able to handle about 6 full-time residents in addition to myself as the abbot. And I believe this year we're going to have that full contingent of 6 folks. Right now we have 4 committed to be there with me initially starting this week. We have a woman coming from Japan in April and then another gentleman coming from Vancouver in the summer. So I think by the summertime, we'll have our full 6.
Excellent. Do you recruit people or do you just kind of wait for people to appear? Like, how does this work?
Yeah, I try to discourage people rather than recruit them.
Yeah.
But we simply mention on our website that we offer this kind of training and someone who wants to commit to residence there can apply. And, you know, I think most people who apply have no idea what they're asking for or what they're getting into because most people here don't have experience of that kind of training. But I would say most of the people who have applied have been quite sincere and are ready to benefit from it. So I've been very pleased with the quality of the people who have shown interest.
Excellent. How often do you turn applicants away? I mean, like people who want to study with you, like how often do you turn away a potential student?
I wouldn't say that I turn anyone away. My job is not to discourage anyone, but to try and find a practice of a type and a level which is appropriate for their conditions. So there might be many people who believe they're interested in living in the monastery and it might not be something they're ready for, but I'd like to give them some other options. We obviously have groups in other places that are not monastic and residential in nature, but which also provide wonderful practice opportunities. So I try to steer people towards the practice which is appropriate for them. The purpose of the monastery is to provide that highest or most immersive level of training for people who can benefit from it. So if someone can benefit from it, they're welcome there. If not, we find something else for them to do because Zen is an open gate to anyone, depending on their conditions.
There is a, I know you have a book coming out on Shambhala, and we're going to talk about that a lot in just a little bit. And but there's an author who is also on Shambhala named Shozan Jack Hobner in the Rinzai tradition. And he was on this show and he told me a lot about like the nuts and bolts of like day-to-day life as a novice monk, like somebody who comes in like on day one, like what's your life like living in a monastery as a student. So that was a really cool conversation to me. And, you know, anybody can check that episode out as well if you want to know about like coming in as a new student, which was a lot of fun. So can we go back in time a little bit?
Please.
So tell me how you found Zen and your teacher.
Well, I've had several Zen teachers actually, but they're all in the same lineage. So really I can talk about the first one, I suppose. My interest in Buddhist practice in general, was from a very young age. I don't really understand the origin of it, but by the time I was in high school, I knew I wanted to pursue that. I did a religious studies bachelor's at Rutgers University with an emphasis on East Asian traditions, and I ended up going to India my junior year, Antioch University in Ohio, and I believe they still run it, has a wonderful Buddhist studies program in Bodh Gaya, India. I was able to participate in that. And while there, I could receive instruction in several different Buddhist traditions. So I would say that was the origin of my actual practice and confirmed for me that I knew I wanted to pursue that path. But as for Zen, I didn't know much about it, and I had no idea about the differences, for example, between Rinzai and Soto lineages or Chinese Chan or anything like that. But by chance, I was also doing martial arts training in a Japanese tradition, Aikido, and I happened to meet a Japanese Aikido Shihan or master level teacher who was also a Zen master, a Zen teacher. He had emigrated to Chicago in 1974. So long story short, when I finished my university study and having come back from India, I was also quite ill. I had gotten tuberculosis while I was there, so I was using martial arts to become healthy again. He pulled me aside when I saw him not long before my graduation, and he said, "What are you doing when you leave school?" I said, "Well, I don't know, but I'd like to study Buddhism, and I'm interested to do martial arts." And he said, "Come to Chicago." So a few months later, I was there, and I was living in what I found out to be was the temple, Zen temple, which he was responsible for. And I lived as a resident trainee under his guidance for 7 years. By the end of that time, I knew that Zen training, specifically Rinzai Zen, which was the lineage he carried, was what I wanted to devote my life to, and everything went from there. So kind of a strange path. My experience of that is what leads me to advise people who are interested in this kind of practice to not focus on the lineage or the style that they think they might be interested in, but rather just to find the teacher or the person that they have some affinity or click with. That's what I had with this gentleman. He was really, I guess, what you would call my root teacher or heart teacher, as some traditions might say. Just so happened that he was a Rinzai Zen teacher. So that's why I followed Rinzai Zen, because that's what my teacher did.
Is that who you received your Inca from?
No, actually not. He passed away, unfortunately.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, he died quite young. Under his guidance, I trained in Zen and martial arts, and he also directed me to begin Sanzen, which is the formal koan study under another teacher, Hosokawa Roshi, connected to the same lineage. So I began training with him and did most of my training in terms of the koan curriculum under him. And then finally, I finished my training under one of his successors, Sozan Roshi, who is still active in Chicago.
Excellent. So I know you did all your training in Chicago, and yes. But where are you originally from?
New Jersey.
Excellent. Okay, cool. That explains the Rutgers connection.
Exactly.
So you have it. So I've been, I read your book and I absolutely love it because it's so accessible to all levels of people. I feel you have a great reverence for teachers in your book, and you reference repeatedly that practicing with a reputable teacher is really important, and that solitary practice is, while it can be good and useful, it's also incomplete. So why is it so important to have a teacher in Zen as opposed to studying alone?
Why is it important to have a teacher in anything?
True.
You know, it's there are some things which, by their very nature, it's difficult, if not impossible, to really learn depending on one's own devices. Zen in particular, because the practice requires us to see through and begin to work with our own obstructions and delusions, the very nature of that means that we are among the most ill-equipped of anyone to decide what type of practice we should be doing. You know, most of us would practice according to our own preferences, our own patterns and obstructions, rather than in a manner which is actually appropriate to our condition. So the teacher's job, first and foremost, is to prescribe the actual format of the path which best fits us. And oftentimes that path is not going to be what's comfortable for us or what we would choose for ourselves. So for that reason alone, I think it's indispensable. Of course, in Zen, we also have this idea that transmission or receiving the teachings from another person is really central to the tradition. This is not just in the sense of being certified by someone else or you know, having things explained to us by someone else, but there's a subtle or an energetic, a vibrational transmission or connection that happens only between two human beings. If Zen loses that or lacks that, if we lose what I would call the physical embodiment or realization of the practice, that can only be caught from someone else's body who's present near us. It can't be caught from a book. It can't be caught from our own self-study. If we lose that, then Zen loses its vitality and it loses its power to transform us. So I wouldn't say that studying under a teacher is preferred in Zen. I would say it's absolutely essential. And if there is a Zen study that eschews teachers or dispenses with that connection with a mentor, it's no longer a genuine Zen.
Understand. How many students have you connected with? Like, have you been able to give transmission to any students under your own tutelage?
No, not yet. It's certainly a duty or a responsibility of someone in my position to do that before I die. The traditional saying is that we should, those of us who are teachers trying to train successors, should be able to find a qualified human being, or at least half a human being, to which to transmit our lineage. And I'm luckily still young. I hope that I will have time to do so. And one of the purposes of Korenji is to provide a place where that can happen. But no, I've not transmitted to anyone yet. Certainly, I hope that will happen in the future.
Excellent. So tell me why you wrote your brand new book, The Rinzai Way.
Well, my experience in the 10 or so years that I've been certified as a teacher is that there are many people very interested in the tradition, but who don't have access to a teacher, or have not, I should say, been able to finalize that connection with a specific teacher yet. That being said, there are still things they can do. There are still some foundational practices they can start to work with, and that they can learn from a distance that will be useful to help them start to dissolve and work with, you know, dissolve their obstructions, work with their own conditions and so on. So my original idea was, oh, I should write something for my own students that can be kind of a reference for when I'm not around, can give them some guidance for those points of practice which are commonly misunderstood. But as I continued to teach and was contacted more and more often from distant or by distant folks needing guidance, again, who hadn't yet found a teacher, I realized maybe this can be useful for them too. You know, even if they never formally study under a teacher, as is required in our tradition, they could still sit. You know, they could still learn a basic practice like breath counting. They can still get that benefit, and no reason not to give them that. So I intend the book to be as wide open a gate as possible, The purpose of it is to point towards the true and formal training under a transmitted teacher. But even if someone just steps inside the gate, if they get benefit from just that much, I don't mind. I feel like that's well worth having written it.
Yeah, there's so many practical little suggestions in the book. There is positions, there is diagrams, there is very detailed instructions on breath techniques, and it's mm-hmm. really got a cool description of like a lot of the physical parts of Zen as well. So how is Zen physical to you? Because whenever people think about Zen, a lot of times they might think about a group of people sitting, sometimes staring at the wall when it comes to Soto Zen, or just like sitting motionless for hours at a time. So how is it physical? Because I know that you have a very physical approach in the book.
Well, Zen is as a Buddhist tradition of yogic practice, coming out from that long history, is psychophysical by nature. There's no getting around that. I think one of the big misconceptions in Buddhism in the West in general is that it's primarily a psychological phenomena, or that the revolution that comes from the practice, so-called insight or wisdom, is a psychological revolution. It's not, it's psychophysical. The theory of the entire yogic tradition, of which Buddhism is a part, of which Zen is a part, is that we are using our mind, but we're also using our body, the breath, the senses, all of these in very specific ways to dissolve, again, our own obstructions, to start to see the patterns of our own delusion, and to change the way we experience things. It's very difficult to change the quality or the workings of one's mind using the mind itself. We have to engage the body and the breath and the senses, the whole embodied being, in order to most quickly bring about transformation. So there's a famous Zen saying, I mention it in the book, I'm sure you're familiar with it, that it's impossible to wash off blood with blood. Mm-hmm. And in that same way, it's impossible to have a practice that is vital and that can really bring about lasting transformation of a depth and profound nature using just the mind alone. We have to use the whole being. And I think that's something, I hope that's something that the book will remind people about. Because again, if we lose that thread of embodied realization, Zen becomes just another type of therapy, and it really dies. And that would be a tragedy.
Yeah. Something that I think is so special about your book is the way that you included a lot of imagery as well in the book. You included the demonstration of multiple sitting postures, which I know that some postures are impeded by people's physical conditions. Like, for example, I had back surgery and knee surgery. So sometimes it's a challenge to get in some of the postures that are most vital in Zen. But you also show how to like find a wide gaze during Zazen. And you even mention martial arts at a lot of points in the book. So what is like your physical regimen, like your wellness regimen, that you can share that might help you to deepen your own practice?
I'm laughing because this winter I've been pretty sedentary and I'm paying the price for it.
It's tough. Yeah. I rode my bike 30 miles yesterday and I'm really in bad shape today.
And writing a book is not good for one's body, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to say that people need to have a specific regimen because, again, it depends on the person's conditions. And I also don't want to give the impression, although I'll say Zen is a psychophysical discipline and that it's an embodied discipline, that anyone is precluded from doing it who might have physical limitations. I mean, there are ways to work with those things. But I think what we need to understand is that Zen is a practice of working with one's mind, breath, and posture constantly throughout the day, whatever one's activities are. Something as simple as the alignment of the pelvis, which is so crucial to Zazen and so incredibly and widely misunderstood, is something that you can work on constantly as you're walking, as you're sitting in front of your computer, as you're working, doing whatever. The idea that our bodies are part of this laboratory of practice and study and should be encompassed within it, and we should become aware of how we stand, how we use our eyes, how we walk through space, what we're experiencing as we do so. That's the real Zen training. All of that is practice. It's not just sitting. To sum up again, I wouldn't say someone needs a particular fitness regimen or anything like that, but what people need to do is get in their bodies and start to understand that the body is the vehicle of practice, and that constantly refining the breath and the posture, it's not a supplement to Zen practice. It is what Zen practice is. That understanding of practice, the embodied or physical reality of practice, I think is a thread that's lacking in a lot of Western Zen. And it's something that really needs to be brought out more. Again, I hope the book can accomplish that.
Sure, yeah. So you keep mentioning the breath, and I think that the breath is one of the most taken for granted things in human life. We go through our lives.
Until you can't do it, right?
What? What'd you say?
Until you can't do it.
Exactly, yeah. Until it hurts to do it, or until it is painful or something. So, but we go through our lives, and the body just breathes for us, and we don't have to pay attention to it so often, but I feel like we're kind of missing something if we don't pay attention to it. It's like it's the vital essence of being alive. So is it sad to you that nobody seems to think about their breathing in their lives? Like, what does the breath mean to you as a symbol?
Well, again, speaking from the standpoint of practice, we can say that the breath in some sense is a bridge between the mind and the body. The breath, in terms of its depth, the way it moves, the frequency, and so on, reveals much about our mental state and also reveals a lot about our physical state. If we learn to work with the breath, we can transform our mental and physical state. And likewise, if we ignore it, the breath is going to start to reflect our habitual patterns, which won't always be the most positive. So it's such an incredibly powerful practice tool. And the oral instructions, specifically in the Rinzai lineage, regarding how to use the breath within practice are so incredibly important and foundational that to me, to do a Zen practice that doesn't acknowledge the breath or doesn't cultivate it in any way is really missing out on the core source of the practice power. You know, it's like trying to drive a vehicle without gasoline. I don't know how one could do Zen training without at least becoming aware of the patterns of the breath and starting to work with them.
So it seems like in the book that you kind of suggest that breathing is a very essential component to successful Zazen, and that people worldwide might just be thinking with their eyes closed, maybe, when they think they're meditating?
Well, the purpose, we have to understand what the purpose of Zazen is. And there's many ways to describe that in the different lineages. And you know, to my mind, none of them disagree with one another. They may have different terminology and so on. But the condition that comes out from practice of Zazen or Zen training in general, what we call samadhi, or the state of meditative absorption, is deepened profoundly and deepened to the extent that one is able to integrate and cultivate the breathing. The breath is what drives the subtlety and the depth of the samadhi condition within the Zazen posture. If someone, again, doesn't engage that in their sitting practice or in their general Zen practice, it is very possible to sit for many years, even with a perfect, so-called perfect posture, and to feel that one is somewhat clear, but really to be kind of fixated in a rather dead state, a state lacking vitality, and a state in which the real underpinnings of one's dualistic confusion or you know, habitual delusion is never really cut through. It is really a shame to see that there are a lot of Zen lineages that seem to have pieces of the puzzle but don't have all of them. To me, the breath is the biggest of those. So
the method that I kind of latched on to when I was reading the book is called, I believe I'm saying it right, Suso Kukan.
Yeah, breath counting.
Yeah, and I think that I could do this practice forever and have it be an endlessly beneficial practice. Like, if I did that, is that sufficient?
Yes, it can be. It's certainly a sufficient method for one's whole life for people for whom that is the case.
Right. So,
but how does one know that? That's the teacher's job to let us know that or to prescribe that for us. We shouldn't choose a method based on our own comfort and preferences. But there are certainly people whose teachers will say to them, yeah, breath counting is the method for you. Just go with it. I don't think that one could exhaust it. It's incredibly profound. In the Rinzai tradition, we use it as a foundational practice, as I describe in the book. But whatever other practices of the many that one may take up later, we always return to it. It's always useful, and I'd never feel like I could exhaust it.
So I am a I'm going to admit to you that this is like a crime. I am a binge meditator, and I'm trying to get away from it.
I'm going to use that. I've never heard that before.
Okay, good, good, good. So I'm a binge meditator. Like, I will go once a week, and I will go like hardcore, or I'll go to an all-day retreat. But it's a habit that I need to break. So everyone that I've spoken to about meditation on the show has like emphasized the daily practice over the binge practice, which I am totally guilty of. And like, so that said, forming habits, especially for me, is one of the hardest things for people to do. What steps did you take to master the habit of the daily practice?
Okay, so practice is a habit, but I don't want to focus on it as habit, because I think what's really missing, and I don't mean with you, but with some people in general who have trouble establishing a consistent practice, isn't that they're not able to figure out how to establish the habit, but that their motivation is not strong enough. If we don't have the practice that's founded on a very deep aspiration to aid all beings, a deep motivation to use our lives in the most productive and wise or useful way possible, the deep motivation to use our existence to benefit others. If we don't have that, if the practice doesn't somehow come from that initial aspiration, we're not going to do it. And as I wrote in the book, we often find that when we try to do things for ourselves, we can be haphazard. But when we are in a situation where we're doing something for others, oftentimes we act with more care. We put more effort into it. I think that's the case with practice. If the motivation and the aspiration are strong enough, we find that we can establish the habit easily. If we find we have difficulty doing that, I think we need to look not just at schedule and habit, but at why are we practicing? And is that motivation sufficiently profound?
Yeah, and I'm so much better whenever there are other people in the room as well. Like, I feel like I can go for hours if I'm just with people.
That's because we get embarrassed if other people see us stop or move. It's certainly helpful.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the things I've been testing out lately is the Kekafusa full lotus posture. Mm-hmm. And it has been, and you wrote in the book that it is an unrivaled method, basically, to progress. Yeah. And I agree. I didn't really understand it until I was successful doing like 15 to 20 minute Kekafusa sits. Do you notice your students who sit in full lotus have easier breakthroughs or more, I don't really know if I want to say enjoyable, but productive experiences?
Well, again, talking about Zazen or seated meditation, in order for that unified condition we call samadhi to manifest, we have to use the body, the breath, the mind in particular ways. And while I can't exactly say why, I mean, I can talk about some traditional reasons that are given for it, but we've known for more than 2,500 years in this tradition that that posture has particular effects on the mind and body. It's a yogic asana. It takes a long time to master and practice, and one shouldn't be discouraged if it takes a long time. But the way that it allows the unified samadhi condition to manifest, for whatever reasons, is, as I said, unrivaled. So we shouldn't be surprised that the things they've been telling us to do for centuries work. At the same time, I think we need to be compassionate with ourselves and patient with ourselves and understand that these are difficult postures that require as much mastery as any other yogic posture. So we take the time that we need to get there. And there's lots of points along the way or different postures along the way that we can use until we do get there. That's no problem.
Excellent. So you've said the word a couple times. I think you said psychological and physical knots, right?
Uh-huh.
So Zen, in your words, serves to sort of like untie the psychological and physical knots that our culture has tied us in. And you mentioned earlier that you feel like we need more of the centers like Kurinji in today's society. So how is our culture, to you, encouraging us to be tied up?
Well, I mean, first of all, in terms of using the body and the mind and the senses in balanced and healthy ways, we're certainly not going in that direction, are we? You and I are sitting in chairs talking through a screen.
Yep.
And a lot of us spend too much of our days staring at screens and sitting in chairs. And that right there is going to have an impact on how we experience things. We have to recognize that. The way we use our senses, for example, we indulge in overuse of focused vision in the modern era, staring at screens, staring at phones, staring at books, text, and so on. That has an effect on how we experience things, and it's not how we were physically evolved to function. We were evolved to use peripheral activation or sweeping vision much more frequently than we do today. Those kind of concrete things, which we can acknowledge and work with, have an effect. And I'm discouraged to see culture or work life driving us towards a type of existence which is much less embodied and much more focused on subjective psychological states and the desire to validate our subjective impressions as de facto important. Zen is going a different direction than that. We have to start to see through our own subjective impressions and states and preferences and get to the root of the fixation on a so-called I or me, which is at the root of much of our delusion. So I don't think the problems we face now are different than have been faced in the past, but certainly things seem to have accelerated in a direction that has cut us off from being in our bodies, cut us off from being in nature and feeling grounded on the earth. There's certainly rather profound challenges today that are greater than have been in the past. So,
Yeah. Do you see? So you kind of see like the tightening of the knots as society speeds up. Do you kind of see that as like being their trajectory? Is it like the knots are becoming tighter as opposed to looser?
You know, the Buddha said his teaching was against the stream of society, so perhaps it was always that way. It does seem there are unique challenges today, though. I will say this, when it comes to something like Zen practice, I think there is a certain remedial understanding of how to use one's body and senses and breath, and just how to exist as a psychophysical being with 2 feet on the earth, that maybe in the past a student would already have, whereas today we have to teach people, okay, this is how you walk.
Yeah.
This is how you breathe not as a Zen practitioner, but just as a normal human being. Please use your diaphragm rather than your chest. We have to teach those things now before we can get deeply into practice at all. So again, if whether or not that's driven by the culture or the direction of human civilization at this point, I can't say for sure, but it certainly does seem to be a challenge greater than in the past.
You know, one of the things that I think about whenever I think about these issues that you're talking about is I spend all of my day in a normal American high school. Mm-hmm. And I feel like as I stand in the hallway and I look around, I feel like someday there's going to be a sort of revolution when so many people realize how much of their lives they have missed due to walking down the street or down the hallway with our faces buried in an electronic device. Mm-hmm. And I almost feel like there's going to be a backlash against that and like almost like a reclamation of real life. I don't know. Maybe I'm hopeful. What do you think?
I'm hopeful.
We have to be.
There will definitely always be revolution and change. I can't say what direction it's going to go. You know, obviously we have a lot of benefits right now too. Things like dentistry are great.
Yeah.
The ability to, from a Zen standpoint, you know, we don't have to take a hazardous sea voyage or caravan journey to travel to the distant temple of a master to learn. We can email a half dozen of them anytime we like.
Exactly. So
in terms of making connections and information exchange, certainly wonderful, but we're losing a lot with that in terms of our embodied existence, and therefore also losing some of the seeds of what makes Zen practice so powerful. That's my concern.
So whenever we're like looking down or we're not looking out into the world, we're missing vistas, basically large views. And one of your favorite quotes in the book is you wrote that you have stunning vistas that are revealed during the path of Zazen and Zen. So what are some of your favorite stunning vistas that have been revealed to you on your path? Do you have like any favorite moments?
I mean, one could talk about specific experiences, but that's not really my interest to do that. To me, they're all variations on the same vista. And it's simply that the habitual way we have of seeing the universe, of perceiving the world, which is that I'm in here and everything else is out there, or I'm inside this case of bone we call a skull behind these eyes, and everything else out there is not me. And everything else out there, which is not me, I therefore go about judging and categorizing. I like this, I don't like that, I want to keep this, I'm going to push that away, and so on. That fundamental way of splitting the universe into pieces we call dualistic seeing. The stunning vista of Zen is when we can transcend that, or when we can see in a way not bound by that. All the Zen experiences, we talk about Kensho or Satori or so-called enlightenment, all of the insight coming from the practice is just that. It's seeing from the standpoint not of a so-called I or me. The more stunning that vista or experience might be is just simply tied to the depth or the profundity of that experience.
Whenever I read that line in the book, I just thought of art and paintings, and it was just such an artful line, and I really appreciated it. Do you consider Zen to be almost sort of like a radical practice? I know you mentioned the Buddha's line earlier of being against the stream. Like, do you consider Zen to be sort of like a radical way of looking at the world today?
I think reality is radical.
Yeah.
And any path which is going to help us to dissolve the sort of habits, you called them, or echoed the phrase I use, the knots, to untie the knots. I use that word to sort of refer to the Japanese jikke, which means the karmic traces, or the karmic habituation and patterns which we all carry in our bodies and minds. Anything which causes us or helps us to be aware and to manifest the particular clarity which can cut through that stuff, because that stuff is not something that most people are working with and can see through. If we start to do that process, it becomes radical. It is against the stream, but it's radical simply because it is real. And waking up from a dream can seem radical, I suppose.
Yeah. So in the book, you open up with each chapter with a quote with a disciple of Zen, and there's one person that really drew my attention, and correct me if I say this incorrectly, but is it Hakuin?
Hakuin.
Yes. Yeah. So he's a master who sort of revitalized Rinzai in Japan, I think, and he organized what Rinzai looks like today. Why does he inspire you? Because I've never talked about Hakuin on this show, and I'm curious if you can just say why he jumps out at you.
Well, he was incredibly gifted, certainly a genius, and one of those people who comes along that the cliche is to say about every 500 years, but approximately every 500 years in Zen, there seems to be one or a handful of people who come along at the right time in the right conditions who are able to inject new life into things. And he was one of those. The way that our Rinzai Zen lineage, as it passed through Japan and was transmitted to the West, was able to survive is purely because of the vitality that he injected into it. And in terms of organizing the practice that we do today, he really brought all of his genius and energy to bear on looking at things like the koan practice, for example, very, very important practice, which Rinzai Zen has refined to a high degree, and setting forth a sort of curriculum or path using that method, which has really turned out to be just incredibly, incredibly useful. So I would say from those two standpoints, in terms of the actual path of practice, Hakuin was quite an organizer and innovator, but really the vitality, the energetic vibration that teacher had and was able to impart to his disciples, who then set about revitalizing the Rinzai lineage in Japan and, of course, into the West, really unmatched. So we're still living off of his energy.
Excellent.
And hopefully by the time another 500 years goes by, someone else will pop up.
Very good. Nice. I've had another thing that I love about your book is the moment where you talked about Abrahamic religion and the fact that we do live in an overwhelmingly Abrahamic monotheistic society. And I had a few Zen teachers on this show, and I thought of one in particular when I read that chapter. His name is Robert Kennedy. He is a Zen Roshi I think he received his Inca from Bernie Glassman, and he's also a Jesuit priest. And when reading your chapter about Abrahamic religion and Zen, Kennedy jumped out because he's kind of like a special exemplar to me for how he's opened himself to multiple traditions and how both of his practices strengthen the other. So his Christianity strengthens his Zen strengthens his Christianity. So in a nation like the United States of largely Abrahamic religious practitioners, how do you envision sort of strengthening dialogue with the Abrahamic Westerners in your region?
Well, I think, as I said in that chapter, an important thing for us to do is to try to be in their shoes and to understand the standpoint of their faith and the underpinnings of the belief system which they carry. I want to say outright that I'm not what I would call a universalist. I think there is a trend in religious thought to sort of say that the different traditions equate to one another, or that the highest realization or experience of each is the same. I don't believe that's necessarily the case. But in terms of dialogue, or for the purpose of dialogue, as Buddhists, as Zen practitioners, we have to be comfortable with using the word God, not for our own tradition, but we have to understand what is meant by God in the deepest sense in those faith traditions, and try to see what language in our own tradition can match with that or communicate with that. Not being a theistic tradition, Buddhism not being a tradition which posits a creator, deity, and so on, there's some real interesting barriers to understanding and communication. But when it comes to the experience of contemplatives, of practitioners, and the types of language they use, there is common ground. And I think by not eschewing words like God and by not avoiding the discussion of that particular issue of the deity, that we can at least dialogue respectfully. That's what I hope for more than anything, is that we can see what the common ground is and just rest with that and let the rest of the stuff take care of itself.
Excellent. So having that knowledge of the context in which you're working, like, you know, all of that is really relevant to where I live as well. So what do you see the role of American Zen being in the future?
Well, certainly our standpoint that comes out from the practice, the realization of transcending the so-called I, directly manifests as compassionate action. So in a society that seems to be increasingly geared towards selfish fulfillment and indulgence of individual preferences and pleasures and fixation on partisan views and so on, the basic teaching of becoming one with the other, or acknowledging the lack of separation between so-called self and other, and being able to approach that other person's viewpoint with a compassionate attitude rather than a confrontational one. That's so basic, but it's what Buddhism can give to the West as much as anything. I hope Zen can do that. At the same time, as I said, as a somewhat radical movement, which forces us to look at the most fundamental ways that we see and perceive and interact in our environments, I hope that Zen can help us to continually destruct or deconstruct the sort of I fixation and the fixation of self versus other, fixations of man versus environment, all of these dualistic divisions which we create in our heads. Zen as a radical movement should be a voice for acknowledging those and trying to see beyond them.
What are a couple of your personal future goals for your own practice? Like, what do you what do you want to accomplish still?
I would like to stop being as deluded as I am.
Excellent.
In terms of my practice at Korinji, or the establishment of that monastery, I've always thought to myself that I have three main goals in life. One is to establish that monastery. So we have a Rinzai Zen training monastery in the middle of the heartland.
Yeah.
And as of this week, we've finished that after 15 years of work. The second goal is, now I have to make it succeed and survive. And the third goal is, I have to find someone who can carry it on after I'm gone, whenever that may be. So the hard work is really now just starting. And I hope that all of three of those goals can be accomplished before I pass on. That's my work now for the next however many years I'm around.
So what's your website? Where can people find you?
Koringi.org, KORINJI.org.
So Roshi, I'm hoping that we can close with a chant, because in the book, I loved how you called the chanting almost like an art form. I had Shozan Jack Hobner do the Heart Sutra, and I'm wondering if you can do the Four Great Vows chant, and then after you're done, maybe talk about what it means a little bit, just in sort of translation.
Sure, no problem.
Thank you.
Shudya muhin segan nuwa buwa nuwa mujin segan dan huwa muwa muryo segan gakub tu duwa muryo segan ju. So those are the four bodhisattva vows, or the so-called four great vows. The first is the vow to liberate or to save all beings. Although beings are boundless, we vow to save them. The second is to cut off the root of bono, or klesha, delusion, ignorance. The third is to practice all of the Dharma gates, not just the gates of the Zen path, but all the approaches to wisdom or enlightenment, to practice and to master them. And the final is that although the Buddha way, the way of supreme enlightenment, is unsurpassed, we vow to attain it.
Roshi, congratulations on your book. Congratulations on the establishment of your training monastery. And thank you so much for spending an hour with me today to talk about your practice and everything that you're doing up in Wisconsin. It means so much to me.
Really a pleasure, Greg. Thank you so much. And thank you for making this opportunity to get the word out.
Classical Ideas is produced by me, Greg Soden. Music on Classical Ideas is performed and composed by Derek Strybing. You can find his music at www.wearewarmmusic.com. If you would like to support this show, please subscribe or leaving a rating in iTunes, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.